This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, February 17th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, the House Finance Committee has put a fiscal plan on the table, and we'll take public testimony on that today. Co-chair Neil Foster from NOME joins to discuss the proposed overhaul.
Our goal has been to structure a long-term sustainable fiscal plan that's comprehensive and fair.
One of our reporters gets a first-hand look at the East Side's annual chilly swim.
The water keeps freezing on top, so they're scraping the water constantly, making sure the ice doesn't build up too much because we don't want folks diving into ice-chunked water.
Dr. Kathy Hyman joins for some medical and maternal advice on riding safe, slow, and protected this winter.
Wear the helmet every doggone time you go out, no matter where you're going, no matter how fast you're going.
The region's longest tenured coach, New Haven's Bob Rychnofsky, joins for our Friday conversation, and we ask some youth about their Valentine's Day experiences.
Dating, I think, is important to get you ready for the special one.
Those stories and more after a look back at some of this week's news. Six were lost at sea last weekend when the 98-foot crabber Destination sunk a few miles northwest of St. George Island. The men were heading out to fish snow crab when the Coast Guard picked up a distress signal from an EPIRB and launched search and rescue efforts. An oil sheen, some life buoys, and other debris were found, but no ship and no survivors. Attorney for the ship's owners, Michael Barcott, says so far no one, Coast Guard included, knows what happened to the Destination.
We know this. This was a really good and experienced crew. The captain and the crew were professionals. This captain had been on this boat for a long time. The boat was in good condition, and it is an absolute mystery what happened.
The search included numerous Coast Guard assets and Good Samaritan vessels from St. George and the fishery. It was suspended after 3 days' effort that covered 5,700 nautical miles. An investor's report published Tuesday from a New York hedge fund slammed the Pebble project as not commercially viable and called Northern Dynasty stock worthless. The report was authored by Carisdale Capital, which specializes in activist short selling and is run by investor Sam Adrangi.
What we specialize in is, you know, finding companies that we believe are overhyped or overly promotional about their prospects. And, you know, we present our contrarian views. And with Northern Dynasty, you know, our research has led us to believe that the mine's not economic. And, you know, that's why its prior partners and investors have walked away. And so, you know, the company's being valued at $1 billion, but we think that that's not the appropriate valuation because the mine will never be commercially viable.
Pebble's opponents hailed Carisdale's report, and the value of Northern Dynasty plummeted by a third within hours of its release. Pebble says the report is full of inaccuracies and was issued by a hedge fund that stands to gain by driving down its stock price. Alaska Governor Bill Walker signed a disaster declaration this week to try and stem the epidemic of overdose deaths from heroin and other opioid drugs. The declaration is intended to make it easier to give overdose victims the life-saving antidote naloxone. Walker says declaring a disaster will enable a coordinated statewide response.
I mean, it's not one particular region, one particular income strata. It is widespread. And it's just that the stories are just horrific from across the state.
More than 100 Alaskans have died from opioid overdoses over the last 3 years. Walker ordered state agencies on Thursday to apply for grants to prevent and treat addiction and to increase law enforcement efforts against drug trafficking. A small airplane belly landed in Unalaska Tuesday, but no one was injured. The Grant Aviation Super King Air 200 came down without its landing gear, though the company has yet to say why. The accident closed the runway for several hours Tuesday afternoon. The airplane sustained some damage. A subsistence emperor goose hunt for this spring has been announced, the first of its kind in 3 decades. The population of emperor geese declined substantially in the early 1980s, and hunting was canceled after 1987. Fish and Game's Jason Schamber says intense conservation efforts have paid off.
Over the last 30 years, the population has grown slowly at about 3% per year. And in 2015, it finally reached a level where managers felt that the population could sustain a harvest.
The Alaska Migratory Birds Co-Management Council is developing region-specific bag limits for the spring subsistence hunt. Permits will be available for a limited state sport hunt in the fall. And last night, sixth grader Ryan Burkowski took first place in Dillingham's annual Spelling Bee. The now back-to-back champ says standing on stage to compete does not seem to get any easier.
My heart's like beating really fast and I get scared. But when they tell me to spell a word that I know, I get really excited.
An elementary champ was crowned as well. Both will travel to Anchorage for the state Spelling Bee in a month. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. Listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. Today, the House Finance Committee will be taking public testimony regarding its version of a solution to the state's now $2.7 billion deficit. Whereas the Senate, under leadership of Republican Pete Kelly, seems mostly focused on deeper cuts to the budget, the House is pushing for a restructuring of how and where the state collects revenue. HB 115 will draw upon a portion of the permanent fund's earning reserves and put in place an income tax. The House estimates the permanent fund earnings would add $1.5 billion for state revenue and still pay out an $1,100 PFD for now. They estimate an income tax of 15% of a person's federal tax bill, or $25, whichever is greater, will raise an estimated $655 million. Representative Neil Foster of Nome is a co-chair of House Finance, and I spoke with him about this last night.
So just to back up for a moment, the problem is a lot of people know that we've got a massive deficit. We've got a $3 billion deficit, and why is that? It's because oil production and oil prices are down substantially. 90% of our state's revenue comes from oil. And that pays for everything from education to health care to our clinics to our VPSOs to our, road maintenance and road plowing and airport cleaning and, just so many things. So moving forward in how we're going to tackle that problem, my goal has been, and our entire caucus and the majority of the House, our goal has been to structure a long-term sustainable fiscal plan that's comprehensive and fair. And I know that's kind of a mouthful, but the thing that I want to focus on is when I say fair, I'm referring to a fiscal plan that doesn't balance the budget on the backs of rural Alaska.
Some, not all lawmakers, have been having this conversation in Juneau and with their constituents around the state for at least the past year. Governor Bill Walker put a comprehensive plan on the table at the beginning of the 2016 session that quickly fell apart ahead of the elections. Now, the new caucus that Foster is a part of, led by Speaker Bryce Edgeman, is committed to seeing sweeping changes put in place this year. Foster says before talking about what the House believes can be done, he likes to remind people of what the caucus is not interested in pursuing to close the $3 billion gap.
So, for example, there's $1 billion out there in the Power Cost Equalization Fund. We don't want to touch that. That's the money that pays to help subsidize rural Alaskans' electric bills. We don't want to do a sales tax. A sales tax is, for rural Alaskans, we pay the highest amounts for groceries and for services and for goods. And so it wouldn't be fair to tax, if you had a 5% sales tax across the state, rural Alaskans, we'd be paying a higher sales tax, and we don't think that's fair. In terms of cuts, in terms of things that we don't want to do, we know that we have to make some cuts, but we don't want to make massive cuts. Further cuts and deep cuts are going to hurt rural Alaska the most, so we don't want to do that either.
Foster says that every comprehensive plan he has seen put forward includes some use of earnings from the permanent fund or the permanent fund itself. The House wants to tie the draw from the fund's investments earnings based on a percentage of the fund's total value. They believe that will put $1.5 billion into revenue and keep PFDs at around $1,100. Another pillar for the House plan is what Foster calls a progressive income tax, and a separate bill aims to reduce and reform oil and gas taxes and subsidies. Then the House will continue to look where to cut spending out of the state budget, the fourth pillar. Foster says he believes this session, the public and the legislature are ready for the tough changes to be made.
There are a lot of folks out there that wish that this would have been done last year. I've got a lot of folks who come up to me and they say, you know, at this point, so many options have been thrown on the table. I just want you to do something. I don't care what it is, just do something. Because people want stability. They want to know what to expect so that they can plan. And I think, you know, the time is right.
Public testimony will be taken today starting at 1:30. The webpage for House Bill 115 is quickly filling up with letters in support and those strongly opposed to the ideas House Finance has put forward. A pair of fatal accidents this winter has reminded many of us about the importance of riding safely and being protected against collisions, especially by wearing a helmet. For more on brain injuries and protecting one's head, I'm happy to have family physician Kathy Hyman from the Conackonack Hospital back with us. Dr. Hyman, it's always good to have you on this program. Thanks so much.
It is a pleasure to be back.
First, let me ask you, just from a medical perspective, what is it about the brain that is so sensitive?
The brain can be compared to a bowl of kind of thick jello in which there are multiple little fibers. Those fibers are the nerve endings that bring the messages from one part of the brain to the other and from the brain down to the body. As you can imagine, that jello of the brain can jiggle when you move. And if your brain, or that is to say your head or your skull, hits something, that can really jiggle those wires and can even make them disconnect or break or tear.
We know that head injuries can be fatal, but there's a range of injuries that we've learned about, not only from the military's experience in the past decade, but also from the NFL and such. What's the range of knocking your head hard to some sort of traumatic brain injury, and what on the medical side do you advise people?
There are a couple of important definitions. The first one's probably the definition of traumatic brain injury, which is some kind of non-congenital, non-degenerative injury to the brain from an external force. That's the official definition. That means you didn't get born with it. You don't have some disease that's making your brain break down. Something hit your head or your head hit something, and that caused the injury to the brain. The traumatic brain injury involves any loss of consciousness, any loss of memory, any alteration in mental status. That means you get goofy. Or any focal neural deficits. That means there's some part of your body that doesn't work. As compared to concussion also involves or can involve a loss of consciousness, but it doesn't have to. And the important difference is that in concussion, there is no CT evidence of bleeding in the head, whereas in traumatic brain injury, there is some sort of CT evidence of bleeding in the head. There's a couple of things that I think are important to think about with concussion. I mean, can you get a concussion just from bonking your head on the shelf when you stood up suddenly in your laundry room? I guess if maybe, but it's probably unlikely. Your skull is there to protect your head.
Against routine bumps and bruises.
Right.
Okay.
But you could potentially get a concussion from falling from a standing height, like walking across an icy parking lot and slip and fall and whack your head. That could cause a concussion. I think it's important that people know what to do with people who they've watched fall. If they get up and they're perfectly fine, they very well are likely to be fine. However, if they have a loss of consciousness for longer than 2 minutes or get up perfectly fine and then lose consciousness later, those are a couple of signs of people that should come into the emergency room.
Okay.
Any child that has a loss of consciousness ought to come into the emergency room. Everybody's allowed to vomit once, but if they vomit more than once after they bump their head, they probably ought to come to the emergency room. If they are confused and that does not go away quickly, and by quickly I mean a minute or two, they probably ought to come to the emergency room.
Okay.
They can look agitated or upset. And if that is not their normal state, they probably ought to come. Extreme drowsiness, weakness, or inability to walk, of course, you're going to want to be bringing somebody like that. If they have slurred speech or a seizure with their fall, definitely should come in. They can also just have perseveration, which means asking the same question over and over and over again. That suggests that something dislocated a couple of those axons mm-hmm. because they're not able to remember the immediate history of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that's on a blood thinner like an aspirin or Coumadin or apixaban or clopidogrel who bumps their head, they definitely should come in because the risk of bleeding when your blood is already thin is much higher.
All right. Just outside of our studio, we can hear somebody firing up a snow go here. And I learned from the school today that they don't let the kids come to ride in unless they have a helmet on, which is a good rule for the school. But we've talked about some of the treatment side. Let's talk prevention briefly. And if you don't mind, I'll ask for Dr. Heinemann's stern words of advice to folks out there starting to ride around again for the first time in a couple of years and such. What do you say about putting on that helmet?
Wear the helmet every doggone time you go out, no matter where you're going, no matter how fast you're going. As a traumatic brain injury survivor myself, on my bike ride home from the hospital, when I acknowledged that I had forgotten my helmet that morning and thought, it won't matter, danged if I didn't fall off my bike and wind up getting medevaced to Anchorage. I didn't even follow my own advice that one time, and it only takes one time. The reason the helmet is helpful is that it gives an added layer of cushion and protection around your skull so that if something's going to crack, it's going to be the outside of the helmet and not the outside of your skull. A second thing that really, I believe, is very important and I would love to see parents taking action on is slowing your children down. I know we live in a place where snowgoes and four-wheelers are very prevalent. My children complained incessantly that I would not let them get a four-wheeler, and my reason was safety. Because I know how fast my children go in a car now. I wasn't about to give them something that they had no protection around them to let them go as fast as they wanted. I think that it's important that you choose a snowgo or an ATV for your child that is appropriate to their size and teach them how to ride safely and teach them to go slow, for crying out loud. I don't know how many speeding children I've nearly hit on Lake Road just driving home, and they're whizzing down the road.
Mm.
Just slow down and wear your helmet.
That is wonderful advice. Dr. Kathy Heinemann, it's always good to have you on this program. Thank you so much.
It is a pleasure to be here.
Last weekend's Winterfest culminated with a very popular event that's been hard to schedule the past couple of years. KDLG's Lawrence Hamilton has more on the invigorating penguin dip into the Naknek River.
My brother texted me last Sunday morning. What does a person do on a cold Sunday in Alaska, he asked. I don't know, I replied. Jump in a lake? Luckily for 11 hardy souls, the 2017 Winterfest was welcoming the return of the penguin dip. Previous winters with their warmer temperatures forced the event to be canceled. This year, the mercury held steady and consistently below zero, with the wind chill making it a balmy minus 25 degrees, negative 50 degrees on dip day. These intimidating numbers are what draws the crowd, but quite a bit of preparation goes into carving out a 16-foot by 8-foot hole on a frozen lake in early February in Bush, Alaska. Naknek Mayor Carl Anderson explains.
Well, they used to use chainsaws back in the day until they started asking the phone company to participate, so we started bringing our machine down here. It's a Ditch Witch. It's like a Swiss Army knife of machines, but the chainsaws, it was a lot more fun.
The object of the penguin dip is to get in and out of the water as fast as possible. Dippers jump in on one side, swim across, and get out on the other side. Hence the name, the penguin dip, as the fastest time comes through by gliding across the water and sliding out on your belly. For this event, being a penguin pays well. The quickest dipper nets $200, with second and third place also getting cash prizes. In case something goes wrong, a rope is tied around Dipper's waist so they can be hoisted to safety. If all this sounds like too much fun, organizer Rebecca Barton and the team were facing another, not surprising, dilemma.
It's so cold out here right now. I think it's around 15 below, so the water keeps freezing on top. So they're scraping the water constantly, making sure the ice doesn't build up too much because we don't want folks diving into ice-chunked water.
As the penguin dipping time drew closer, pickup trucks and SUVs parked around the edges of the lake, and slowly large men with icy mustaches and beards, along with women with frosty eyebrows, stood around to watch these sockeye suckers. A man participating in the dip somberly showed me his iPhone, which displayed a wind chill of negative 23. Other participants seemed apprehensive but excited.
I think the worst part is going to be getting out of the water. going to be pretty intense, I think.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm jazzed. It's one of the activities I enjoy here. I like to. It's very cold today, and there's wind, so that's going to compound things.
Oh, I'm feeling good. I like doing this.
At this point, the time for nerves were over, and participants headed to the heated trailer station next to the watering hole and waited for their numbers to be called. At this point in the story, one might expect to hear the cheers of the crowd and the gasping of dippers as they claw their way out of their frigid water. But this reporter got a little too involved in the story and discovered firsthand what the allure of penguin dipping was all about. So what does jumping in icy water on a day with Arctic blasts feel like? I have to agree with my fellow dippers.
How does it feel now that it's done?
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, it was a good experience. I'm glad I did it.
What was the worst part of it?
Signing the paper.
Oh, I feel good. I'll do it again.
I'm ready to go again. I hurt my knees, but I'm home. Two ladies did it. Woohoo!
It was awesome. It really wasn't that bad. It stayed pretty warm considering. I'd like to do it again.
Everybody keeps saying it's not bad. We'll get more contestants next time.
Yeah.
From IC King Salmon, I'm Lawrence Hamilton.
Thanks for staying with us here on Bristol Bay and Beyond. Bob Rychnofsky has been the New Haven boys coach since 1979. He has led the small 1A school to 5 championship games and brought home the title once. Over nearly 4 decades, scores of New Haven's young men have grown on the court and in their character under the leadership of Coach Bob. He has frequently been named Coach of the Year, and the new multi-million dollar gym in New Haven bears his name. Bob Rychnofsky is a special education teacher by profession and has his team in Dillingham for the tournament this weekend. I asked the coach to join us for our Friday conversation, first to talk about how the sport helps build character in his boys.
What they do in basketball pretty much reflects what they do in off the court, in the classroom. And, you know, there's a set of checks and balances on participation in athletics, and that's that they are staying eligible. Staying eligible means academically eligible. Also, being able to work with teachers, work with people in a system, and work in a system. Being able to work in basketball as a system. And so it's like the school system or any other system they're going to get themselves into after graduation. And the goal, you know, during the basketball season, you know, you work with these young men, and you really want them to stay eligible because you want to win. You know, that's a big thing. But more important is that they graduate in the end. So that's the bottom line, is you want them graduating so they get that diploma and then they get employability skills so that they can be successful. They're achieving the goal that you want for them, and that's to be able to be young men who can hold on a job, support families, and if you, and when you when they graduate and they aren't able to do that, then you kind of feel badly that you haven't necessarily, you and the school, you know, and the whole system hasn't pretty much done what it was supposed to do for them.
What are some of your goals as a coach? What are some of your guiding principles?
Well, I like to get, by mid-season, my goal is to get the leadership developed so that they can pretty much run a practice on their own. And not that they're alone at any time. I'm there to do the job that has to get done. And also be able to make decisions in the basketball game on the floor that reflects what we want to do as a team in terms of winning. I've also many times every year, multiple times over the year, I try to reiterate to the ball players that you know, they represent Lake and Peninsula School District and the village and of New Haven and the school. It's more important that they act properly on the court, display good citizenship, sportsmanship, than it is that they win.
How important is character, and how do you foster that?
Character is the bottom line on anything. Kids with character have heart. They display it on the basketball court by starting off in practice, working their butts off, conditioning is the bottom line in terms of being able to play the game to begin with. You can't play defense as well at the end of a game as you do at the beginning of the game without conditioning, and that's hard work. Hard work is the ability to work hard, to have a goal and to work towards it is one of the main signs of having character. And that is being a worker, having work ethic, is probably the main ingredient for success after school also. So that ability, so character to me is work ethic. I've had some really successful ball players in the past who aren't necessarily talented ball players. If they went to and tried to play ball in college, they probably would have a lot of difficulty doing it because they aren't really as talented. But they, on the high school level, they can achieve a lot just through the work ethic.
Another aspect I think people notice when they watch New Haven teams play is they play as a team. They're quick. They move the ball around fast. They're always looking to find an open shooter, set a pick, play good defense, grab a rebound. Is that part of the overall philosophy of the girls' team, too? It's not just your boys, but how do you foster that level of teamwork that I think sets your even smaller school apart as being one of the toughest competitors around?
Well, I'll take that as complimentary, and I'm not sure we're there like that all the time, but that is the goal. That is the goal, to do that. I think we've had at New Haven, we've had a consistent philosophy administratively. We have teachers who stay around a long time. We have a real good discipline, I think, in terms of overall school discipline. And I think our district-wide, the students in Lake and Penn are very polite, and I'm not sure why. It has a lot to do with parents.
Yeah.
In fact, you get into that, I think we have a very, very active group of parents in New Haven who work with the school, work with the kids, and genuinely have the interests of the kids and the school at heart.
Well, I sense a great deal of humility from you, Coach, but I will ask you about the high points of your career, and I just want to reference that when they christened that new gym, they put your name on it, and I saw photos of how they had asked all the men who had come under your coaching through the years to stand up, and that was pretty much every man in town under the age of probably 40, and I think that's a pretty neat testimony to your career. But as a coach who's coached almost 40 years now, what stands out to you as a high point?
I don't think there's any single high point. There are many, many games which stand out where the kids did well, worked their butts off, and really did well for themselves. I think the high point for me, a couple of them. One would be the consistency we've had. I think we've been we're a very small school. But for example, right now we only have 13 kids in the high school, but we've remained competitive in our region. I've seen a number of schools come and go, and then they're here and there, and there are some really good other. Well, teams that have done well over the years. But I think we've been there most of the years and been competitive. And I'd like to have people remember me in the past, I'd like to have them think that I was fair. That would be there's another issue here, another thing too, though, that people think of me as a basketball coach. I'm a special education teacher.
Right. Coach Bob Rignowski from New Haven, it's good to have you in, and good luck the rest of this weekend and this season, of course.
Well, thank you. We have it's a fun group of young men I work with, very nice young men, and it's been that way for a long time, so it's enjoyable to do.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And that's just about it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Band Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. We appreciate your feedback and story ideas. Email me at dave@kdlg.org, and don't hesitate to give us a call here at the station anytime. My thanks to Avery Lill and Lawrence Hamilton for their help. I'm Dave Benninger. We're going to leave you this week with a post-Valentine's Day audio postcard with some area youth and what's on their minds when it comes to love and dating out here in rural Alaska.
Kate Gomez. I am a sophomore at Dillingham High School. Teenagers like that are in school, they depend on school trips, like sports and stuff, and they find someone that they think they like, and then they start talking, and then eventually they start quote unquote dating. And so it's just really, really hard to find someone. This one time I went snuggling and we're going. And we didn't see the drift. We just thought it was with the snow because we were going really fast and it was snowing and our goggles were getting like blurry. And we were going really fast and we didn't see the drift and we almost fell off. And it was pretty fun. You have to be like really careful who you start to talk to because you may be related to them. And since this is like such a small community, you don't really have many options. It's for the way you look at me. Oh,
it's for the only one I see. Jaden, and I'm in 10th grade. I go to Dillingham High School. Pretty much related to everybody that comes around here somehow.
Zachary, and I'm in 10th. I pretty much know most of them are my cousins. To you, love is more than just a game for two.
I'm Juliana Roll and I'm in 10th grade. There was one time where this kid had asked me if I wanted to go smelting with him, and I've never went smelting before because I'm from Anchorage, and he was just trying to introduce me into this whole native lifestyle. So he's like, all right, let's go smelting. I was like, okay. So I get up at 9:30 and we go, and it's like a 2.5 hour snow machine ride until Lewis Point, and there's like 5 other people with us, and he chipped away my hole there, and he's like, this is how you do it, and he taught me how to smelt, and then after that, he built me a fire and totally cooked it up for me, and I had smelts for the first time, and I totally shared with him, and it was super fantastic. That's what you are.
Unforgettable, though near or far.
It does get kind of weird when you become friends with a lot of people, and then you're like, I don't know if I like you, and then you just start dating, and you're like, I don't know, I kind of like you better as a friend. So this friend relationship, and sometimes it's just weird to choose between the two.
Kendra Kapotic, and I'm in 10th grade. You have to find a very unique way to go out on a date, and it's pretty interesting. I've gone out in snowgo rides and smelting. I've actually gone smelting. Yeah, and going to watch ball games. That's pretty much it.
I'm Jimmy Nikolai, and I'm in 10th grade, and I'd say probably the best date is probably going snowgo riding or like any kind of riding. I'd probably go Warehouse Mountain because it has the best view of the trees and everything.
My name's Sam and I'm a sophomore. Dating, I think, is important to get you ready for the special one. Well, it's really different because in Wyoming, we used to go to the movies or out to any restaurant we would desire, but here, you don't have very many choices, and those few choices are often closed, and so your only choices are really what you have at home. And I like to cook for my girlfriend or take her on a snow go ride or, you know, outdoor stuff. Live free, be happy. And forevermore, that's how you'll stay. That's why, darling, it's incredible that someone so unforgettable thinks that I am
unforgettable too.